Hello, this is Ben. Quick notice for this week's regular scheduling. I had some microphone issues this week, so it sounds a bit like I'm talking through a sock. My apologies. I hope it's relatively listenable and it doesn't detract from your audio experience, but we'll be back to normal, beautiful, rich audio sound quality next week. Anyway, I hope you enjoy the episode. Hello. Oh no, that's not good. You're right, they're always a bit cringe, aren't they?
Yeah. I honestly think the shorter the intro, the better.
Okay. Wait, let's try this. Hello, I'm Ben.
And I'm Janice.
And I'm Ines.
And this is The Tangentialists, the podcast where tangents are not only encouraged, but relied upon.
That one was good.
How are things in the United Kingdom?
Very rainy.
Yeah.
It seems as though our prior predictions about a national lockdown might be coming true. So it's a good combination because it justifies you staying inside on two levels.
I see. So one is a kind of moral, virtuous, doing your bit for the country thing. And the other part is you just not wanting to get wet. And they combine to completely justify you staying in.
Yeah. Yes.
Very nice.
Unfortunately, I think the weather might switch at some point and then that might feel less easy to like rationalize into staying inside.
I wonder if there's a correlation between the country's weather and the transmission. I mean, okay, obviously there is to a certain extent with temperature, but I was thinking, more along the lines of, you know, if it's really rainy a lot, people won't go outside and therefore they won't spread viruses.
Do you know what? I think it probably is the other way around because it's rainy people when they meet, because people meet anyway, like people just are sociable, and then they'll meet inside rather than outside.
Okay, no.
So on that note, we'd like to welcome the audience to the country's leading epidemiology podcast.
That's right. That's true.
It seems as though overnight we've all become experts in the field.
Well, honestly, I think 2020 has made epidemiologists of us all, really. I mean, it's remarkable how much I will talk to people and they will tell me with complete authority and sincerity that, you know, we're due for a second wave, or this is how immunity works. And I am partially to blame. I'm partially implicated in this because I will talk about concepts like a second wave and antibodies as if I didn't learn these terms 2 months ago, you know. It's quite remarkable. I think maybe it's indicative of this post-expert world we live in, where everyone seems to think that they are, in fact, the expert.
The expert is Google.
Yes. Also, it's a curious phenomenon I used to recognize in school was when boys, and I'm sorry, it was always boys, would be like, oh, if I was the England football manager, I would do such a better job. And then they'd proceed to explain why they were the expert England football manager. And I feel like that's also the case with coronavirus. Everyone suddenly thinks that they would be the world's best health minister and they would be able to sort out this epidemic where no one else can.
I mean, I imagine this is somewhat where this idea of wisdom comes from, right? That over the course of your life, you live through so many things, and by virtue of having lived through these things, you've gained some knowledge about them.
Yeah, but I think this is a good example where none of us, I mean, the Spanish flu, like, it was such a while ago that, I mean, most of the people who are out there giving their opinion about how governments should run things have not been through any pandemic before.
I mean, as an example, I would say I was talking to someone here in Spain and they were saying that what they should do is they should lock down everyone for 2 weeks. And they meant everyone in the entire world. This is a global coordinated lockdown. And then they should get snipers to stand on the roofs and shoot people if they left their houses.
Oh my god, that's not good.
I mean, yeah, but they were adamant. They were like, this is how we should do it, you know, this would solve the problems of the world. This is a person that had no formal training in epidemiology or medicine in any form, but it was just so adamant that they knew that this is the way forward.
You know what I'm really confused by? If the snipers are shooting people, they're outside.
Oh,
so how are they interacting with one another?
And who collects the bodies?
They
just brought there?
The bodies get left out, that's fine. But the snipers have to be... The snipers are a massive risk factor in this whole equation.
They are.
Indeed. I've heard many, many creative solutions to global problems in the last couple of months, which has been amusing and somewhat alarming sometimes. People reveal their true colours when they are trying to fight the global pandemic, is all I will say.
They do.
All right, guys. And on that note, I want to start off this podcast by taking you from the year 2020 back around 600 years in time. I was doing some reading this week for my degree, and I came across one of the most remarkable extracts I've ever read in my life. And I thought I would share this extract with you, and I'm particularly interested in hearing what Ben has to say about this, because his position as an educator currently might be of value in this discussion. But to give some context, this was in the 14th century. A lot of the teaching of the church was combined with the teaching of the law, just because those were kind of the big educational institutions. And so they tried to mix these things together. And so you ended up with some interesting, to put it that way, scenarios sometimes. So one of the examples by which they attempted to teach people is this following extract that I'm going to read out to you, if you don't mind. Satan appears before the court of Christ to bring an action against mankind. It is an action for depriving hell of its rightful possessions. The defendant fails to appear on the assigned day, and Satan asks for judgment by default. Christ grants an adjournment on the ground of equity and by virtue of the judge's discretionary powers. The next day, the Virgin Mary appears as an advocate for mankind. Satan objects to her, first on the ground that she is a woman and unfit to be an advocate, and secondly on the ground of her relationship with the judge. Christ overrules the objection.
So someone's written a fan fiction about the Bible being about law. Is that what I get from this?
Roughly, I suppose. But the idea behind it is you wanted to teach the population about both kind of Christian values and procedural law at the same time. What I found really interesting about this is it's a very odd mixture, and to the modern eyes or ear, it does not really make any sense whatsoever. Am I correct in saying that?
Yeah, I got a bit confused. I'm gonna admit that here, right? Yeah. Here. I don't really know what happened.
Well, yeah. Yeah, but my point is, from your perspective as an educator, Ben, do you think combining subjects like this is an effective method of teaching?
Well, I really appreciate it. I really feel like my ego is being stroked when you call me an educator. that feels like greatly beyond what I actually do.
Would you consider the role of educator to be more prestigious than that of teacher?
To me, educator is like a kind of American marketing term for teacher, you know? It's kind of like saying, I don't want a career, I want a vocation. It's like, I'm not a teacher, I'm an educator.
I see.
But then teacher is like, isn't that like an age group as well?
Yeah, I suppose you're right. I suppose, educator is more generic, right? And then you can apply some principles to it. So I guess from my soapbox as an educator, I would say I would say this is perhaps not a particularly effective way to teach, mainly because it involves knowledge of both subjects prior to understand what on earth is going on, I would say. You'll need the teaching of neither subject because it involves a pre-existing knowledge of both.
But, you know, Ben, I find it interesting that you say this is bad because it presumes knowledge of two areas, whereas I think in a prior episode we were talking about teaching and you made the point that actually the mainstream thinking now in teaching languages in particular is that you involve the person in kind of in discussions about things, and in a way the teaching of the language happens in a more indirect manner. But I'm not sure that is too different from this, right?
Yeah, okay, that's a reasonable point. I think it's an effective way to teach the law, providing you understand the religion. Yes, perhaps you're not. Yes, it wouldn't be an effective tool to teach both things at the same time. But yeah, there's an argument to be made that taking existing concepts and principles people know about, you know, people understand in the 13th century or the 14th century, people understood very well the relationship between Jesus and the devil and the Virgin Mary. And so using that pre-existing relationship to teach a legal concept, I think is quite a clever idea. Yeah, I think that's pretty inventive in a sense. You're always looking, I think, when you're trying to teach someone for ideas and structures and what was the word you used, Jonas, the other day? Fact patterns. You're looking for the fact patterns that they may well know in their life and then try and apply it. You know what, honestly, I've kind of noticed, and this is a good tip for learning, and anyone at home, if you consider yourself a self-learner, I'd recommend this. It just make sure the examples you learn are so unbelievably silly that you just won't forget them. So I've resorted to, when I want to teach a word like to run, I will just Google a funny GIF of a dog running, and the children love it. They love it. And they always remember it much better than if I just got a boring picture of a person running. So I guess my tip here is, and I think this works for self-learning as well, if you deliberately learn the most ridiculous things possible, it's generally quite a good way to learn, to get something to cement in your mind. So Jonas, I look forward to you trying to explain some legal concepts using some GIFs of pugs running up and down. Maybe a little pug with a little wig on in a courtroom.
Oh my God.
little doggy jury as well. I think that would be great.
This is an interesting thought. Should this be true, that the way we teach people should radically change once they kind of finish their 11th, 12th school year? Because I definitely felt like that was true for, at least for myself, when I came to university. You know, because the point I was going to make was teaching people law through these types of, you know, GIFs or whatever might be very effective at younger ages, but I query its efficiency at the university level.
It's funny, I was having a conversation with a teacher about just this, and she was saying how when you start in Spain, when you start learning English, but I think this is true for many subjects, you start with songs and dancing and colours and drawing, and it's all fun. And slowly as your years goes on, these things get swapped out for tests and memorising and verb tables. And then you get to 18 and it's just miserable. It's just, you know, memorise, you know, apply. Everything's grey, everything's black, everything's white. And it's like, well, why is this happening? Why do we slowly drain the joy out of subjects the older you get? And I didn't have an honest answer, because I think adults would quite enjoy a little colouring session, or maybe even a song and a dance.
Yeah, I suppose the point is that the more knowledge you acquire about something, the more the knowledge that you are still to acquire becomes complex. In which case, the more complex the idea, the more difficult it is to convey in songs and colouring and things as such.
Yeah, no, that's probably true, actually. As you would hope it would be, you would rather you didn't start off with the complex things, you know. You didn't start off with a complex introduction of restitution for, that's the one,
oh,
one
God.
The one complex law word that I know, and try and teach it to 4-year-olds through the tweenies or something.
I mean, in a way, our emotional energy, this is going back to what we talked about last week. You know, if you sat a 4-year-old in front of a textbook that explained exactly what you might learn through the songs, but more, it's just they wouldn't have the desire or willpower to go through with it. In which case, you know, the sad reality of it is that in many ways these educational institutions, when the older we get, the more they take advantage of the added motivation that society instills in us and the willpower that we have to kind of do well.
Yeah,
I mean, brains change as well, don't they? Like when you're a kid, like you need kind of like dynamic, bright things to even capture your attention, and then by the time you're 18, I think there's this assumption that you can do it without and just get straight to the core of it.
Sure, but I'd still like a good coloring session or a nice song.
I had this idea that, like, I think maybe there are different forms of interaction you can do, like with learning. where, for example, like when you get older, I think you start doing more like group projects or debates, and that requires very different kinds of interactions, but it's still fun, I think. So it doesn't lose all of its, like, it just changes.
I think there's something in Jonas's idea that it's a bit of a shame that in a sense we move away from these concepts, because I think sometimes there's value, even when you're an adult, to have someone explaining something to you as if you're 5 years old. But you know, because, well, when you're first learning something, at least having the basics explained to you in the most simple fundamental way is often useful. And I think sometimes we can look down on those teaching methods and think, oh no, it needs to be complex and it needs to be age appropriate. But actually, if that's the method that perhaps worked best all that time ago, then it would still be the best. And I've recently started trying to learn things on YouTube. I've recently realized that YouTube is an absolute goldmine for adult learning or kind of ongoing education. And the very best videos aren't the ones that go into complex details sort of explanations that might be appropriate for my age, but they're the ones that treat me like I'm a 5 year old and they sit me down and say, okay, this is what this is, and this is what this is. There aren't any songs, admittedly, although I could probably find some. But I don't know, I think sometimes the best way to learn is just to strip out the needlessly complicated bits and just pretend you're a 5 year old and just go from the very beginning.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, in many ways, the same stands true for very, very complicated concepts in the law. You learn them best if they're explained to you in really, really simple terms. And that's in many ways, I don't think it's controversial to say that that's the hallmark of a good teacher.
Their ability to make complex ideas simple and digestible and easy to understand.
Yeah. And importantly, I hear a lot of mathematicians talking about this idea, but making complex ideas intuitive, which I think is a really important part of our understanding, which is often overlooked. You know, you want to be able to draw on our general intuition in order to explain these quite complex concepts. And you know, a lot of from my field at least, a lot of legal education and law in general is precisely that. You're drawing on kind of your general intuition to determine what the right result is in certain cases. And then you reason between these cases to try to see where the appropriate differences and similarities are. But a lot of it is just, you know, figuring that out using this very basic intuition.
So interesting that you mentioned that's the hallmark of a good teacher. I was wondering, for you two, who do you have a teacher in mind who really stands out as someone that was your best teacher or the one that influenced you the most? And was it because they explained things simply, or was there more to it?
I think there's a difference between influenced me the most and the best teacher. Because I've had teachers, you know, typically English teachers, who talk about life a lot and have said things that stuck with me. And I still sometimes like think about. So I'd say that's like influential. But then the teacher who was the best at teaching their subject, I guess I had, obviously, okay, well, my geography teacher was pretty good. He took no shit from anyone. Like, he was very much like to the point. And I think what he did that was pretty good is that he made us, I think that's the nature of geography, is like he made us like really talk about where we came from. And like, essentially, he took advantage of, I was in an international school, so at least I had that advantage of having such different perspectives, especially in geography. So he, like, it was more about using your peers as like something to learn from, like a place, a source of knowledge. And so it wasn't like who you were with in the class mattered so much. I remember I had him for 4 years, and I had years where it was more or less interesting, but I think, yeah, it was like using every individual in the class made a big difference. And then, yeah, he was also very like, he made us take our research, like he told us to basically find a key, an example, like a a case study and find our own interest. Basically, it was very it was guided but individual to some extent. So you would go for something you cared for, and then you would find it more interesting. It would stay longer in your brain. And I mean, successfully, because I now finished a degree in geography. So,
yeah, I think there's an interesting question as well between teachers that are good teachers to you and teachers that are good teachers. Because I found that in many ways, the teachers that I learned most from, or that I think, you know, caused me to develop myself in the greatest manner, were probably not what you would describe as great teachers. But I think that is because different people will respond to that type of teaching in different ways, right? So, you know, one of my tutors comes to mind who was mostly quite harsh, quite dismissive of most ideas, and kind of just ran with whatever he thought was right, didn't bother explaining it that much, and just did what he wanted to do, which by no means sounds like a great teacher. And I think, you know, on many people, that form of education, if one might call it that, doesn't work very well. But then some people respond by some form of intrinsic drive to try to impress that person. Call that what you might. But, you know,
it really doesn't sound that healthy.
Well, no, I agree. So hence why I say if you want to refer to these people as good teachers, it's probably a misnomer. But in many ways, they to me personally, they were great teachers if you look at the outcome. And so maybe what I'm trying to get at is that there's a distinction between good teaching and the outcome of teaching, if that makes sense. Ben, would you agree with that?
Well, yeah, I mean, what you've touched on is the thesis of the film Whiplash. Have you seen Whiplash, either of you?
I have seen Whiplash.
Oh, amazing. That's very rare that I'll be able to talk of a film that
it's post-2000, so what did you
No, of course you've seen it. Well, yeah, I mean, the central kind of tension of that film is J.K. Simmons plays a kind of basically abusive teacher, and he has this gifted student who's a drummer, and he basically sort of verbally and on some occasions physically abuses this boy, or torments him perhaps to get him to become a better drummer. And the teacher's argument is that the two most dangerous words in the English language is good job. You should never try and tell someone that they've done enough and that they can always learn more. And the tension of the film is that although he's portrayed as an absolute monster, that the drummer does end up getting to the point in the film where he needs to be. He gets to this point of being a fantastic drummer. And it's a very uncomfortable film, incredibly well done, very tense all the way through, in my opinion. But yeah, I think it explores this idea really interestingly between the difference between the outcome of learning and the way a teacher can inspire you. Now, quickly before I say, I think that, you know, the J.K. Simmons tormenting character is definitely in the wrong, because, you know, I think if you consider learning a lifelong pursuit, it's very likely that you would burn out on that kind of constantly being shouted at and abused. And I think it's focusing on outcomes is a very short-termist view of education. And in a way, the best thing you can inspire in someone is a love of something that they go away and they learn it themselves. Because I think most of the learning we do, and this is especially true at university, is self-motivated and self-guided. And so if you can teach someone to love learning about the subject, then I think that's the best job they can do. I don't know, as a film that you've both seen, what are your thoughts on this kind of this tension?
I mean, interesting that both your examples of slightly aggressive teaching are men. I mean, I feel like that is a very, like, not to make like generalizations, but it's an approach to learning that's very like individualistic and like pushing, like it doesn't really accept like more subtle forms of like interactions, and it strives for the best, only the best. And I think it's very, it's just toxic, isn't it?
Yeah, and I think that's what Whiplash does show, and I agree it is completely toxic, because this poor drummer has kind of breakdowns throughout the film, and you can see how unhealthy the whole thing is.
And I think your point of like individual learning and coming from you rather than being pushed like incredibly hard is the strength of someone who enjoys learning. I think if you need to be pushed, then that's probably not like the approach you should have to whatever topic. So either it's not for you, like you don't like that topic or that subject or etc., or it's maybe that you're just not approaching it the right way. I think a push should be an encouragement rather than like an aggressive like displacement of someone towards something better. And I do think this is a very like old style approach, and yeah, I'm not really gonna encourage any of that, because even if you do come out at the end of like at the other end being better, like you're better at what you do, but you're like broken somewhere. Like you haven't won. You've just succeeded to like fully submit to like this aggressiveness.
Absolutely. And yeah, I don't want for a second anyone to think that I'm advocating the abusive style of teaching that that Whiplash shows. Yeah, not at all. But it's an interesting thing that makes you separate. It forces you to separate in your mind the outcome, where this guy becomes a fantastic drummer, and the methods. You know, it's a question of whether the means justify the ends with teaching. If someone's learnt or achieved what you want them to achieve, does that mean that your processes were justified?
But there are multiple outcomes to this. There's the outcome of his skills, yes, like he's managed to become very, very good. But he's also a person, and he's also like had like a thought process throughout the whole learning period. And that is part of the outcome. It's your mentality. Mm. And how is that going to take him further? Like if it's that is, and I think that goes back to your point of being like self-motivated. You are your best like motivator. Like if you can't motivate yourself, like any other form of motivation will be probably less good, even if it can be helpful. But you need to have someone who knows how to motivate you so that you motivate yourself.
Yeah, I mean, I can see that. The only reason I struggle with that just a little is, okay, we all have summer breaks, right? In our summer breaks, we have absolutely... Or well, I suppose, Ben, your last summer break has passed this past summer. But
wow.
While we were at university, we all had summer breaks. And while you're in your summer break, you have no deadlines, nothing of that sort. And I'm not going to lie, I did absolutely no work in any summer. That's not because, you know, that's not because there wasn't any work for me to do. I could have done it, but there was no kind of hammer over my head being like, you have to get an essay in next week or something like that. And so you can say, yes, what is most important and what is best is intrinsic motivation, and I agree. But I just query whether if we were to rely only on that, we would actually, at least, you know, from a personal experience, I query whether I would have gotten anything done.
But Jonas, is that hammer being placed by your tutor, is it really there because of that tutor, or is it you who places it there? I think,
well, it's a mixture of both, right?
I think some people like wouldn't do anything if it weren't for their tutors, but I think others, they want to do well, so they do well for their tutors. It's a bit different.
Yeah, I mean, I have to say, I recognize the subtlety Jonas has added to this, which is that although I have just waxed lyrical about the importance of self-motivation or really wanting to do something, I think very often my motivation to work was of the fear of upcoming exams, you know, or the the fear of not doing well in something, or even if it wasn't fear, it was just the need to tick a box, pass an exam, something like that. I wasn't learning simply for the love of doing it. I was doing it because I had something that I needed to work towards and that I needed to do. And yes, in a sense, that sort of, I hesitate to call it fear because that sounds wrong, but the pressure or the stress was, in a sense, a motivating tool in my education. Obviously, education is a very individual experience, and some people are motivated by pressure, some people are motivated by stress, and some people are motivated by feeling they're free to indulge in whatever they like. But I mean, it's interesting, isn't it, how, as far as I'm aware, every single country in the world examines students. They have exams and they have assessments and they have things that have to be done. And I wonder if we removed all exams and just said to students, you can go into class and you can learn what you like. There's no assessment, you just go and learn. I wonder what would happen. And it's curious to me that there's no country in the world that, of my knowledge, that has ever tried this. And so to me, yes, it probably is very traditional. I think it's pretty much Victorian, you know. But it's interesting to me that clearly it has some level of effectiveness in that it is used around the world. Perhaps that's a fallacy of mine to assume that it's effective because everyone uses it. But it's almost difficult to imagine another way, in a sense.
I'm pretty sure I was talking to a girl in my course and she was telling me that I think she was from Norway and that she had done a year between starting, maybe was it before the master's, of like attending like a school. I can't remember what it was for, but it was like a semi-academic subject and there was no exam at the end. Your attendance was what mattered, and as long as you like did the work and like participated, you would pass, but there was no exam at the end, and by doing the work it was like, you know, preparing for the classes. So
but even in that context, there's, you know, if you don't do the work, you don't pass.
Yeah, but it's like you're doing it to make sure that you're prepared for the class. It's not that you're going to be tested on. It's assumed that you learn it once you've done the class.
But you're assuming that people are doing it because they want to be prepared for the class and not because they want to pass.
Yeah.
Right. Like I can see the point, right? I think there's a lot to be said for education without exams, but I think as long as you're in all these instances, what you're doing is you're holding a stick over someone's head and you're saying, if you don't do this, I won't reward you. So, you know, there's the carrot, yes, but in all of these educational systems, there's also a stick. And when we take away the stick, as we do in our summer holidays, I get jacked on. And I think, you know, I just gave this a quick Google, and apparently Finland's educational system has no standardized testing. It only has a voluntary exam. But in many ways, you know, Finland does very well in world education.
I mean, it's revered as the best education system in the world, isn't it, by many, many metrics. Which is interesting.
But I think, if I'm not mistaken, it still has kind of mandatory school attendance. I have no way of substantiating that claim. But
yes, no, I'm fairly sure. I'm almost certain that is in fact true.
Okay. So apparently there are only 9 years of compulsory school that Finnish children are required to attend.
Okay.
But yes, regardless, you know, there's always, in all of these systems that we see, there's some form of stick that is hovering somewhere.
I was thinking about the idea of a stick, whereas like it's a punishment. So it's quite like, it's like motivated by the fear of pain, I suppose. Like that's what the stick was used for, I guess, back in the day for education. And I think maybe nowadays it's not so much about this, but it's like a fear of failure. Not to bring it to like a too deep level, but I think, for example, a lot of people I've grown up with, it's a lot of expectations are set on them, and it's just this idea that everyone is going to succeed, right? And if you don't go through the hoops, get a degree, get a job, then you're not making it, and you're a disappointment. So I think it's a bit more complex than a stick.
Definitely. Well, I mean, I think in a sense, yeah, I actually really think that it does work like a stick in that sense, and it shouldn't, but I think that's the reality of it, is that's how it does work. And I have a friend who's one of the most intelligent people I know, but he is very dyslexic and he hated school. He hated it because he was constantly being told he was a failure. And yeah, I think that is the modern stick in a sense, is you can't beat children anymore, but you can make them feel like they're worthless or they're not worth anything. And this friend decided to leave formal education basically as soon as he could, and is now runs his own business and is, you know, doing fantastic things. And it's a shame because, yeah, he was failed by the system, in a sense, by a system that was only willing to measure him in one way and was willing to brand him a failure. I mean, he left to GCSEs with basically no, well, you know, very limited number of GCSEs. And yeah, I think in a sense, education does still work with a sort of stick system, by telling you that you're not worth it if you can't pass these exams, which, by the way, are pretty useless, you know? I mean, I think the way in which we're encouraged to memorize things is so unbelievably archaic. And it's a feature of almost every examination system that I've come across, including my degree. But maybe that's an Oxford thing. I don't know. Okay, so to run the risk of what I was talking about in the start of the episode, I want to ask you, if you were made the global education minister, or you were in charge of all education in the world, how would you reform the system? Would you get rid of the exams, or what is it that we should be focusing on? What should our principles of education be?
I think the problem is that if you're trying to provide effective education to everyone, what you can't do is use the same system to educate everyone.
Mm-hmm.
And so for what you need to do ideally is to cater to different people. But the problem is, you know, what this runs into is people making decisions about their whole lives and their futures at way too young an age. And you know, you see this reflected in the difference between the US and UK higher education system. You know, we do a bachelor's degree in something very specialized and take no subjects outside of that, whereas in the US you kind of do a bit of everything. And so the question is, in some way, not just how far to specialize at a young age, but also, you know, how do we teach people at a young age? Because, you know, some kids will have absolutely no talent or ability or desire to learn about kind of chemistry, and, you know, query whether there's any need or any point in teaching them about chemistry in a normal classroom. Equally, others will be really good at kind of teaching at being taught in really intensive in individualist settings, almost akin to the Oxford or the Cambridge tutorial/supervision system, at much younger ages than we've been exposed to them. Again, that doesn't work for everyone. So I think the okay, again, this comes from someone with absolutely no clue about education policy. But the key to this to me seems to be that what you have to do is you have to provide different things for different people. The problem with that is, how do you sort out who does what, where you get your supply of teachers from? Because as I understand it, we don't have enough of them. And you know, those are practical issues which mean that we cannot put our ideal educational system into place, if that makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's really true. You have to consider, yes, there's a resources issue here, isn't there? I mean, I'm sure if everyone had their own personal teacher, then you could learn at your own pace and learn in the ways that were good for you. I think classrooms, in a sense, are always a pragmatic trade-off, in a sense, between the resources that you have and the best educational outcomes. I don't think anyone would reasonably claim that the best way to learn is to be sat in a class of 20, 30 people, sometimes 40. All learning the same thing off the same hymn sheet. So yes, I'd like to hear Inez's vision for a global education system.
I don't know, frankly. I mean, for global, it's I think I've heard so much about the failures of the English system, and then I know enough about the Swiss system. And what I can say is what's like very different between the two is that like the Swiss system tends to push you towards vocational training really early on, and actually only 25% of children actually, well, children, well, teenagers by then, actually get the equivalent of an A-level. And then anyone who has that qualification is allowed to go to university almost for free. So it's a very different system where the vocational aspect of like doing things or like the career of being into like a vocational training is very highly regarded. Like people who like come out with different forms of qualification, they get employed straight away. They have a job by the time they're 18, and they've had like 3-4 sometimes years experience. So it means that the workforce isn't like, not the expectation, definitely in Switzerland, is not to end up with your A-levels. The expectation is to end up with some form of qualification, but it doesn't push towards people going towards academia. And in some way, that's highly criticized, because obviously some people, you know, get their like, you know, their academic ambitions together at the age of 13, by which you're already put into this class that's like pushed towards vocational training. And that's unfair also on like boys, it's been said, because boys get their like their brains basically mature like a couple years after girls in the like learning sense. So it's kind of unfair that they would have to take that test when, you know, like they're not exactly on the same level. I mean, that those have been arguments. And then, yeah, it's interesting the way that like the UK and Switzerland are so different. And I think I see the point in putting a lot of, you know, valorizing vocational training, because like your people, like your friend, like that's all he needed, right? Is like someone to put him in a context and perform in a job where he can use his skills at his advantage, and like things like dyslexia won't get in the way, or he'll learn to work around them. And I don't know, it's obviously, it has its flaws, but I think it's important to like kind of like tone it down and remind people that like not everybody needs A-levels, not everybody needs to go to university. Like, it's, if you want to, you should be able to, and that's the key of it. And you should encourage, we should have like equal, I mean, this is very like ambitious, but everyone should feel like they could get there. And that's currently not the case. But it's also like, I think a lot of people go to uni just to go to uni, you know, like even I'm kind of like, I kind of felt like I went to uni because I was interested in something, but I didn't really know what I was going to do next. And I'm only starting to get that idea, but yeah, I don't know. I didn't really say anything specific except that, like, I guess that stick that hovers behind us should not be telling us that if the formal academic path doesn't seem like where we want to go, that's like a failure. Did that make sense?
Yeah, no, it did.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah,
I like how I like how both of our answers to that question began with, well, this is a really hard question, and then went on for 5 minutes to explain why this is a hard question, and then come down with some, you know, fairly vague, fairly general statement about this would be maybe a good thing to do, but who knows really. It's a very, very classic, you know, Oxford tutorial style answer.
I'll defend myself here saying that like I don't think there's a global answer, but I definitely gave you a comparison between two systems and pros and cons for each.
I think that was a fine tutorial answer, Inez. I really,
thank
I don't
you.
Think, yeah. Jonas, you don't harsh the vibes here, please, okay?
Doing my best.
So my dream education system, I know you guys went for vague concepts, but I have 3 points. Are we ready? Are we ready? 3 points for my global education system. And I appreciate I have fully assumed the role of the world's best England football manager, as we'll call it here, thinking that I know best. But number one, we put snipers on the roofs. Okay. No, not that one. But okay, I have two, actually. Number one is that the number one goal of education, childhood education, should be teaching people how to learn. And I think that's absolutely vital. One, because most jobs that exist now won't exist in 10 years' time, or will exist in a form that's so radically different that there's no point teaching about it exactly now. And I think teaching people how to re-educate themselves is really important. The three of us will have many different careers over our lifetimes. And, you know, after the first or second career, we won't have the benefit of the education we once had to help us, because these jobs will be so new. And so teaching people how to learn and teaching them the joy of learning, because I think learning is a joyous experience if you're learning something that you like and are interested in, is really important. So that involves how to use the resources around you and that sort of thing. And then the second thing we need to teach, I think, is emotional resilience to children. Because I'm not sure I was taught this. I don't feel like I learned this properly, and it's something I'm still trying to learn. But learning, I think in any job, whether you work for the government, whether you're self-employed, whether you work for a big company, you need to be able to bounce back. And I really don't think education teaches people how to bounce back at all. Maybe you could argue it's something that you can't teach. Maybe it's something you have to experience. But I think giving people the tools to bounce back from things is so important. I think if we could see education not as an end in itself, you know, you need to learn these set of facts and knowledge that will set you up for your life, or that, you know, that you can then, well, in fact, not use in your life. We should see it much more as a place to set you up for a whole life of learning. I think there's a risk in seeing that learning stops when you leave formal education, but that is patently not true. And we need to stop thinking that way. So that's what I would do if I was global education minister.
Not bad.
Thank you.
Yeah, sounds very, very, you know, if that job ever opens, maybe you can retrain yourself to take it.
Sounds good.
You'll have the skills to relearn.
Hopefully I will. Although no one taught it to me, so maybe I won't. It's unfortunate.
But the emotional resilience bit only works so if, like, kids aren't being, like, shut down, right? You can only be emotionally resilient to so much, which goes back to our point about, like, emotional energy from last week. Mm. But you can't just tell people who've been, like, told they've, like, failed 5 times, oh, just go, you know, get back up, try again. I think there's also, like, it comes from the student, but it also has to come from the teacher, and we need to, like, think in a way that when someone doesn't perform, it doesn't, like, have a consequence so big that they feel like they don't have the energy to try again.
Absolutely. That's a really good point. Thank you. Yeah, I think you're completely right. I think the only way you can teach emotional resilience is just by giving someone the safe environment in which to fail and in which to bounce back. Because, yes, you can teach someone the brain chemistry behind what it feels like to fail. You can read them stories of other people failing, but the only real way they learn how to do it is by trying. And yeah, just...
And maybe rethinking the meaning of a failure. Like, a failure, when people hear failure, it's often like the end point, right? It's like you've tried, it hasn't worked. That's it. You're finished. It's the end of the story. But failure should be, maybe the word in itself is a block. Like, maybe it should just be seen as like an unsuccessful attempt. Like, you haven't fully gotten there yet, but it doesn't mean everything went wrong.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And then that's the danger of having number and letter grades, in a sense, in a way, I think, is that it's like, this is what you're worth now. You're worth this. And yeah, I'm not sure there's much of a way of seeing progress in that.
But then you and I remember when we didn't have grades, we couldn't feel like our work was gratifying, even if we worked very hard. So maybe right. we're the product of like very trained little students here, but still, I feel personally like I need a grade to get motivated.
Yeah, and then we get into an interesting, somewhat circular argument here about whether, oh, is that because that's what we need? Is that what people need to be motivated? Or is that just because that's the system we grew up in, that that's what we feel we need? You know, could you teach people not to value those things? And for us, unfortunately, that's an impossible question to answer because we've had the education that we had. And yeah, you're right. But you're right. Grades, always a big motivator for me. I loved a grade.
All right, guys. I think that's probably a good point to wrap this up.
Yes, I think so. We've talked about education for a long time. We have shared vague ideas. We've shared specific ideas. Hopefully we've given you some food for thought, something you can go and learn about.
And hopefully we've managed to draw some connections between the 14th century and 2020.
Maybe.
Which is always quite an interesting endeavor.
Exactly, to fully wrap things up.
If you've got this far, thank you very much for listening to The Tangentialists. We hope you enjoyed it and learned as little as Jonas and I did making it. If you have any comments or questions or just want to shout at us for something that we've said, you can email us at thetangentialists@gmail.com. That's the name of the podcast, @gmail.com. We'll be back next week, but until then, keep things tangential.